Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in veterinary neurology, Gemma Walmsley. Thank you, Gemma. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, and thank you to our listeners for attending today. So I'm going to be talking to you about intervertebral disc disease. So in this session today, I'm going to talk about the pathogenesis of intervertebral disc disease and spinal cord injury, our approach to the neurological patient, including neurolocalization, differential diagnosis, investigations, different types of intervertebral disc disease, and then rehabilitation and post-op care, as referring vets are often involved with this side also. So let's start with a few cases. I'm just going to give you history, presenting complaint, neurological examination, and then I'll pause a little bit for you to have a think about your localization and differentials for each case. If you're doing this on your own, you can do it in this order, or you can skip and come back at the end if you prefer. So our first case is Spike, who's a 5-month-old Staffy. He presented with acute onset paraplegia, and his owners found him like this in the morning when they got up. The neuro examination is here, so I'd like you to consider what your localization is, and also there's a very important thing that I haven't told you about his neurological assessment. Okay, so for those that thought he had a T3L3 myelopathy, well done. This dog has reduced tone in his pelvic limbs, which is due to spinal shock. And the clues to this are in the fact that he's got a shift Sherrington posture and a cutaneous truncate cutoff around the thoracolumbar junction. And I didn't tell you before, but he's able to feel his feet, i.e., he turns his head and looks round, and he vocalizes when I squeeze his toe, so he has deep pain perception that's intact. So what would your differentials be in this case? Okay, so the differentials for an acute onset non-ambulatory paraplegia or paraplegia like this would be some sort of vascular or traumatic event, although this happened potentially while he was at rest, although he wasn't observed at the onset. So fibrocartilage embolisms are a possibility, also traumatic disc extrusions. Fractures would be unlikely in this case, as it takes quite a significant trauma to do that, but secondary to neoplasia, that would be possible. Inflammatory and infectious diseases tend to come on a lot more slowly than this, and degenerative intervertebral disc disease is a major differential here. So here is another case, if we could start the video. And we can watch the gait of this dog. So this is Molly. She's a 5-year-old Cocker Spaniel, and her neuro exam is written down here as well. So thanks. Yeah, if we play that again, and consider what your localization and differentials for this case are. So Molly has a C6-T2 myelopathy, worse on the left. That gait that you can see in the video is what we call a two-engine gait. It's short-strided at the front and ataxic at the back, and that on its own indicates a C6-T2 myopathy, but the Horners and the reduced reflexes on the left foot also support that. So differentials in her case. Usually for chronic progressive conditions, we're looking at inflammatory or neoplastic and degenerative problems with degenerative problems usually have a slightly slower progression. Congenital malformations are also sometimes possible depending on age, breed, and presentation. So for both of these cases, they have very different presentations, but intervertebral disc disease is a major differential. Intervertebral disc disease is a differential for any localization. C1C5, C6T2, T3L3, or L4S3. It can be acute, subacute, or chronic in presentation, and it's common. In fact, it's the most common cause of neurosigns in dogs. Its estimated lifetime prevalence in dogs is 3.5%, and certain breeds are predisposed. So, Dachshunds, in particular, their lifetime prevalence is up to 20%. So, I'm now just going to discuss the pathogenesis and then how we approach these cases and diagnosis and treatment. So this is a diagram and cross-section through a normal healthy disc. There are three parts. So the nucleus pulposus is in the center, which is normally a jelly-like cushion that's between the discs, and they act like shock absorbers. So they're encased in the annulus fibrosus, which is made up of a number of concentric fibrous rings that hold the nucleus pulposus in place, and the cartilaginous end plates either side of the disc are also considered part of the disc. So normal nucleus pulposus is about 80% water. It's hydrated, so we can see it on an MRI scan. So here are the intervertebral discs that you can see here in between the vertebrae. This is a T2 weighted sequence in which water is bright. And as discs become degenerated, so what this one here and also the LS disc here, you can see they've lost that bright signal, so they've lost water content and become degenerated. And this spine's here just to remind me that they are in between all vertebrae except C1 and C2. So there's two types of intervertebral disc disease. Chondrodystrophic breeds have early aging of their discs and accelerated degeneration. Many have degenerated discs by 2 years of age, and this occurs throughout the vertebral column. They get chondroid degeneration of the disc with invasion of hyaline cartilage and calcification of the nucleus pulposus. Let me just grab an arrow. I was just trying to. Oh, there we go. So this disc here, you can see that the nucleus pulposus, instead of being looking like clear jelly, has become white, and that's calcified. And that this predisposes them to acute extrusions or Hansen type 1 intervertebral disc disease. In chondrodystrophic dogs, degeneration is throughout the spine, but the most common sites of extrusion are around the thoracolumbar junction, and we think this is probably because that's a high mobility area. It can also happen in other breeds, particularly if isolated discs are damaged by trauma, for example. Discs in dogs with non-chondrodystrophic breeds usually undergo more gradual degeneration, which affects the disc variably. So this disc here shows a disc with fibrous degeneration. There's degeneration of the annulus fibrosus and the nucleus pulposus. So the nucleus becomes fibrous, becomes firm, and it puts pressure on the annulus, leading to bulging of that, and also annular hypertrophy, which leads to chronic progressive compressions, Hansen type 2 disc disease. I'll just move that arrow out of the way. So, intervertebral disc disease leads to pain and varying levels of neurological deficits depending on the localization and degree of spinal cord injury. I'm just going to briefly overview spinal cord injury here because if you understand a bit about this, it's important for decision making in these cases. So, we have the initial mechanical injury, which is compression or contusion or laceration from your intervertebral disc, which damages the spinal cord neurons and blood vessels. This then sets off a secondary injury cascade that leads to further damage. So in the acute phase, the first couple of days, there's edema, hemorrhage, ischemia, inflammatory cell infiltration, and the release of cytotoxic products and further cell death. Secondary injury leads to necrosis and or apoptosis of neurons and glial cells, including your oligodendrocytes, which are your myelin-producing glia. So you've got loss of neurons and demyelination. In the subacute phase, there's ongoing edema, vessel thrombosis and vasospasm, all leading to worsening ischemia, and persistent inflammatory cell infiltration causing further cell deaths. You start getting loss of architecture of the spinal cord and little microcavities, and your astrocytes start to proliferate as well. So your astrocytosis produces this astrocytic scar, which matures cystic cavities, and axons continue to degenerate. So at this stage, axon regrowth in the chronic phase and cell migration are inhibited. So these regenerative mechanisms are all inhibited by the time you've got this chronic injury. So it's the acute and subacute phases where we can make most difference to the injury mechanisms, prevent further axon loss, and prevent any injury getting worse, and hopefully help improve the prognosis of our patient. For example, if you've got a case of intervertebral disc disease, if you act quickly and decompress the spinal cord, then you can hopefully prevent some of this cascade. So moving on to case management, we approach any neurological patient in the same way. So you start off with your history, physical and exam, neurolocalization, make your differential list and tests to get a diagnosis, and then treatment plan. So I'm just going to run through this. In your initial consultation, you may already have a dog of a chondrodystrophic breed that's giving you some clues as to what's going on or a compatible presentation. There are important questions to ask in the history, both in terms of getting a diagnosis, but having an awareness of what the prognosis is and what the owners have been observing, how long things have been going on for, when they first noticed a problem. Was the onset associated with exercise is an important differentiator. Which limbs are affected? Is there any lateralization at the onset? Was there any pain? Have there been any signs of pain since? And when did they last observe important functions like walking, voluntary movement, or urination? Has there been any incontinence, urinary or fecal? Don't forget to do a good physical examination, including checking if the bladder is distended, because these cases can have urine retention, and secondary detrusor injury can be a problem. Also, always check if the patient has good symmetrical femoral pulses, as thromboembolic disease can be a differential for paraparesis. So localize using your neurological assessment, as we did in the two cases at the start. Important parts of the neuro exam, particularly for spinal problems, are gait and postural reactions, muscle bulk and tone, reflexes, presence of deep pain perception and sensation, and spinal palpation to see if there is any pain. This just shows the pathway for the cutaneous trunky. So this reflex can be helpful at localizing further for T3L3 myelopathies, as it's quite a big area. If there's an obvious cutoff in the lumbar spine, that suggests a lesion 1 to 2 spaces ahead as the spinal nerves run slightly caudally. So your input is sensation in the skin dermatomes, which then travels in the spinal cord. And the output to the cutaneous trunky is via your lateral thoracic nerve, which can be affected by C6T2 lesions. So if that's completely absent and you've got other signs consistent with a C6T2 myelopathy, then that might be why. So putting your neurological examination together to get a neurolocalization, which limbs are affected, and are there any lower motor neuron signs can help you work out where the problem is within the nervous system. If you've got multiple lesions or shift Sherrington posture or spinal shock, there are potential pitfalls to your neurological assessment. As we saw from the first case, the neurological examination was slightly conflicting. Your neurological assessment also gives you information about the severity of the neurological dysfunction, which correlates with the injury that the spinal cord has had. So for progressive myelopathies, proprioception is the sort of the least severe thing to be lost. Then with increasing severity, movement from loss of movement to complete absence of movement in paraplegia, and around that time also voluntary urination is lost, and then nociception with deep pain perception in particular, is the last thing to be lost. And by superficial pain, I mean skin pain. So if you was to squeeze the webbing between the toes and that was present, then that would be intact superficial pain perception. Deep pain implies that you've tested for sensation of pain on periosteal bone. So check the toes, medial and lateral digits, and the tail also if it seems to be absent, because the presence or absence that is a big thing to discuss with owners prior to going ahead with referral and surgery, if that is the case. And recovery often happens in the opposite way. So they'll get sensation back first, then movement, then proprioception. So, loss of deep pain perception, because these where these fibers are located within the spinal cord cross section. So, deep pain fibers are located deep within the spinal cord and throughout the spinal cord cross section, which is why they are last to be lost. So, loss of deep pain perception implies like a functional transection of your spinal cord. So, this is a fairly comprehensive list of conditions that can cause spinal cord problems. And as we did for our examples at the start, we refine this for each individual case based on their presentation. Some of these conditions are acute or chronic. Some are particularly seen in certain breeds, for example, vertebral malformations, and some are only seen in specific localizations, so wobblers in the neck and lumbosacral stenosis. So, to diagnose intervertebral disc disease, we're going to have to do some imaging, and we'll be guided by where we've localized and what we are planning to do next. So, I'm just going to talk about radiographs a little bit because that's probably what you have most access to in practice, and they can sometimes be helpful, but not often because they don't show the spinal cord. So, here's a radiograph. If you can see what you can see here, I'm just going to pause for a second. So on this radiograph, you can see that the intervertebral discs, quite a few of them, are calcified. You see these ones in the lumbar spine as well. This disc space here, you can't really see one of those calcified intervertebral discs, and the disc space looks a little bit collapsed. And it potentially looks like there's something within the vertebral canal at this level if you saw that. Oops. So this is a myelogram which outlines the spinal cord, and you can see that thing within the vertebral canal is actually extruded disc material in this case, and it's severely compressed. So myelograms are useful pre-surgery for extradural compressive lesions. We've moved away from doing them in veterinary neurology with wide availability of MRI. So as I said, radiographs are probably what you have access to in practice. So, in many of these cases, you might be wondering whether to radiograph prior to referral. And if we consider differentials and if it will change what you do, for example, you've got a Dachshund that's got an acute onset T3L3 myelopathy and non-ambulatory tetraparesis, your major differential is going to be intervertebral disc disease. The dog needs to be referred for surgery. So sedating and radiographing will at best not really change what you do, but there are also risks. So sedation can affect your spinal cord perfusion and those secondary injury mechanisms that we just talked about, or moving the dog around under sedation can actually make sometimes more disc material come out. So it potentially make things worse. If you've got a cat that's had a road traffic accident, for example, though, and is presenting with spinal shock and no deep pain perception, if you have radiographs that look like this bottom one, then that's going to affect your decision making a lot. As in this case, probably you wouldn't refer and would recommend euthanasia to the owners if the cat has no deep pain perception. The prognosis for this is pretty poor. A dog with chronic back pain and pyrexia, for example, though, radiographs can be helpful in diagnosing discospondylitis, but MRI can pick up changes earlier than this. You need a few weeks for this to have been going on before you start seeing radiographic changes. CT can be useful, particularly if dogs have implants or pacemakers and we can't do MRI. But I'm just going to talk more detail about MRI because that's pretty revolutionized clinical neurology. It's become more available. When I first started doing neurology, we didn't have out-of MRIs and we used myelogram and CT, but now where I work, we use MRI in the majority of cases for intervertebral disc disease, and it's probably the accepted gold standard for most spinal conditions amongst veterinary neurologists in the UK. You don't necessarily need to see where the extradural compression is in intervertebral disc disease, but you do get a lot of extra information from the MRI. You can see everything. You can see the disc that's affected. You can see the other adjacent discs to see whether there's sign of degeneration, which will affect your surgical planning as to whether you want to fenestrate those as well. You can see the spinal cord, which in cases with severe lesions can give you prognostic information, that you can see the extent of the spinal cord injury within the cord. You can see what the material is that's compressing the spinal cord. So you can see if it's hydrated or calcified. You can see if it's mostly hemorrhage, for example. So that's information that there's some advantages to prior to starting surgery. So, moving on to talk about different types of disc disease. So, type 1 disc disease tends to have a per-acute or acute onset. It might be that your dog has started with sort of acute onset pain and then some progressive neurological deficits sort of following on from that over a few days. The age can be varied. Usually, sort of normal breeds of dog, it's they're older, sort of over 5, 6 years of age, but earlier from 2 or sometimes even younger than that in chondrodystrophic breeds. The cervical and thoracolumbar regions of the vertebral column are most at risk. Most commonly these occur from T12 to L2, but they can occur anywhere in the neck or back. And here are CT and MRI images showing what that looks like. So here is a CT of the vertebral canal showing this calcified material within the vertebral canal, and this is what a similar thing would look like on MRI. So here's your spinal cord pushed all the way here over to the right of the vertebral canal, and this dark material here is calcified disc material that's compressing the cord. Management options for intervertebral disc disease, for acute intervertebral disc disease, include conservative and surgical options. And the choice between these is important for prognosis. So, if you've got pain or mild paraparesis, looking at this row here, the final outcome is good for both, or reasonably good for both. And they have a similar prognosis whether you go for conservative or surgical management, although you potentially get there quicker with less chance of recurrence if these cases are surgically managed sometimes. Surgical management makes a difference though if their signs are more severe. So your non-ambulatory paraparetic dogs, for example, those that are incontinent as well. And if you've got they have a 80 to 90% chance of regaining the ability to walk and a good quality of life with surgical management, whereas sort of 50 to 60 percent, perhaps a bit better depending on whether they've lost continence or not, with conservative management. And the most severe cases, if they've lost deep pain perception, then surgery and surgery as soon as possible makes a big difference. And whether you go for surgical or conservative management makes a difference to how quickly you get there. So it makes a difference to your recovery time. So that's quicker with surgical management, particularly in, again, the more severe cases down here. So by conservative management, we mean analgesia, strict exercise restriction, and I'm much more strict with conservatively managed dogs than for ones that I'm resting post-operatively following surgery. And it can be done at home if you've ensured that they have normal bladder function. Obviously, you will also consider sort of how they do over the first couple of days of conservative management. If you've got a dog with sort of mild to moderate paraparesis and you're trialing conservative management, you'll want to assess them fairly regularly to make sure that they are their pain is controlled, that you can control their pain with analgesia, and that they are responding. So you would hope to start seeing improvement, and certainly no deterioration if signs are continuing to progress in a dog that you're initially decided to manage conservatively, then you may need to rethink matters. Surgical management implies decompression, and I will come back to approaches for decompression of the spinal cord in a minute. Analgesia, usually for a shorter period of time, because you've taken away the material that's compressing the spinal cord and nerve roots and causing that pain. Restricted exercise and rehabilitation, so physiotherapy and controlled exercise. Move that out of the way. So there are different approaches to the spinal cord depending on the level and the location of the disc within the vertebral canal. The middle picture shows hebelaminectomy, which is most commonly used for thoracolumbar disc extrusions, which are our most common. A ventral slot surgery is the usual approach in the neck, and we use a dorsal laminectomy sometimes in the neck and also for lumbar sacral compressions, just depending on the structures, the ease of sort of getting to the spinal cord and the structures are around for the approach. We usually use a high-speed air-powered burr and rongeurs to remove the bone, and I'll just show you some intraoperative pictures. So here at the bottom, you can so this is T13L1. You can see the bones here. We've removed all the muscles and attachments, and you can see starting to drill here. This bottom one here is the hemilaminectomy that's been completed. So we've removed the articular facet and the bone in a little window here so we can see inside, and you can see the spinal cord. Sorry, that's the window. You can see the spinal cord here at the top, and this is the disc material that's compressing the spinal cord. And then here on the bottom is after we've removed the disc and decompressed things. So you've got the spinal cord here. Not looking like it's being pushed up anymore by that disc material, and the nerve root here coming out too. So before I move on to talk about type 2 discs, I'm just going to talk about traumatic disc extrusions briefly. So this is what happens to healthy discs. So you have a normally hydrated nucleus pulposus, which is extruded during intense exercise or trauma. They've had a variety of different names over the years. So, traumatic disc extrusion, acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion is the current favorite, also previously known in some of the literature as high velocity, low volume disc extrusions. So, these tend to happen in younger dogs. Non-chondrodystrophic breeds are very per-acute onset at the time. Of injury, and they're not usually progressive and they're not usually painful. So you can have a little bit of progression at the start, and you can have a little bit of pain. Often owners report that they vocalize as they go down while they're running, you know, to chase a ball or something like that, or jumping to catch a frisbee. But non-progressive and non-painful usually after that by the time that you see them. And as I said, it's a normally hydrated nucleus pulposus that extrudes. So usually, so these aren't a compressive type of injury. MRI shows. So if we just look at this image at the top here, you can see this brightness in the cord, and that is showing that you've got an area of edema, your contusive spinal cord injury. The prognosis is usually good if deep pain perception is intact, but if they have severe deficits, in particular if they don't have intact nociception, then the prognosis is poorer. So I'm now going to talk about type 2 intervertebral disc disease. So just a reminder, so your type 2, you have rupture of the inner layers of the annulus, partial displacement of the nucleus pulposus into the annulus, fibrous degeneration, and annular hypertrophy. And you can see acute extrusions on top of chronic compression in some of these cases. So you've got this chronic protrusion, and then suddenly the fibrous nucleus extrudes. So not all cases fit discreetly into a specific type. They don't all read the textbooks. So type 2 disc disease is typically chronic progressive neurological deficits, and they're often painful, although some dogs are more stoical than others. Varied age of onset, particularly older medium to large breed dogs, usually non-chondrodystrophic breeds, as I said, and usually this occurs in cervical and thoracolumbar regions, most at risk, but can occur anywhere in the neck or back and can be multi-level as well, which makes it them a little bit more difficult to train sometimes. So you can see this case here, this disc with the arrow, the spinal cord here you can't see, and you can see the bulging of the annulus ventrally here as well. So prognosis and choice of management depends on the severity of the clinical signs, as for most of our neurological problems, and also the progression as well. So conservative management's appropriate in milder cases that have not been sort of rapidly progressing. But if their signs are progressive, if they're painful, ongoing, that's not responding to rest and pain relief, if they have failed conservative management, if signs are recurrent, as soon as you start to increase their exercise back up again, then surgery is indicated. And the variety of approaches depending on the level and location of compression within the canal again. So we're going to talk about type 2 intervertebral disc disease, a component of Wobbler syndrome and a component of lumbar sacral stenosis in a minute. But for thoracolumbar disc extrusions, again, hemilaminectomy is one of our options, but there are a couple of other alternative approaches to thoracolumbar disc for chronic protrusions, because your disc protrusion is very discrete, just above, just associated with the intervertebral disc space. It's not sprayed around like it does when you have an acute extrusion. So we can be a bit more conservative with the amount of bone and disc that we remove. So there's other approaches like a mini hemilaminectomy, as you can see here. So we that preserves the articular facet, and a lateral corpectomy, which just removes actually the bone at the side of the intervertebral disc in the vertebral body. So moving on to talk about Wobbler syndrome. This is a multifactorial condition, and there are a number of different things that can be happening in a patient with Wobbler syndrome, one of which is chronic intervertebral disc disease. So in an individual patient, you might see a combination of these, and there's clinically two major forms of Wobbler syndrome. So the first is seen in young, large breed dogs, giant breed dogs, sorry, not usually related to the disc. So they have an osseous compression coming from the facets. So I'm not going to talk too much more about that. In older large breed dogs, though, we have disc-associated Wobbler syndrome, like Doberman Pinschers, who have a breed predisposition. So we have disc protrusion, canal stenosis, and subluxation, all going together, leading to this dorsoventral canal narrowing and a compressive myelopathy. Some cases are static, some cases the compression gets worse as they move. We call these dynamic compressions. And these are generally chronic compressive C6-T2 myelopathies. So, conservative management with exercise restriction, using a chest harness rather than a neck lead, analgesia, physiotherapy, and hydrotherapy. So I prefer treadmill hydrotherapies because they tend to keep a neutral neck position better. And these can be successful, particularly for milder cases. A study in 2008 over 100 cases found about 80% of cases improved or were stable with long-term follow-up. So conservative management can be appropriate, as I said, particularly if they are milder. Surgery is indicated, though, particularly if they have a sudden onset of severe signs, marked pain that's unresponsive to medical management, progression or recurring signs, or failure of conservative management. And there's more than 20 techniques described for various types of Wobbler syndrome. So there's direct decompressive techniques with either a dorsal or ventral approach, and a large array of stabilization techniques that have also been reported as well. So there's not a lot of studies that have done direct comparisons of these, and like a lot of conditions where many techniques are described, there isn't one that's demonstrably better than the others, nor one technique that performs well in all cases, really. So there's a big difference of opinion between spinal surgeons, depending on their background, whether they're neurologists or orthopedic surgeons. So, basically, we consider in each individual case where is the compression coming from, and that's where we take the approach from. So, for your disc-associated Wobbler syndromes, if you have a single static ventral compression, a ventral slot is what we go for, which is what you can see in this top case here, which is from a little Dobie with a disc-associated compression there. And then the more controversial thing for some cases where you have multiple levels of compression, or whether you have a suspected dynamic component, is whether we stabilize or not. And in some cases, we do. So, moving on to talk about degenerative lumbar sacral stenosis, this leads to clinical signs of pain, reluctance to jump up, weakness, sciatic dysfunction, so paresis, atrophy, proprioceptive deficits, reduced residual reflexes, particularly hock flexion, flaccidity of hamstrings, leading to superhydroflexia of the patellar reflex. They may have motor or sensory deficits in the perineum and tail, urinary or fecal incontinence, and usually lower motor neuron bladder dysfunction if they are going to have that, as they have reduced sphincter tone. So this is due to compression of the cauda equina within the vertebral canal and/or the L7 nerve roots as they exit the foramina. So combination either intervertebral disc disease and protrusion, or a combination of this with foraminal stenosis from spondylosis, for example, of that disc. It's again multifactorial, as I said, and the compression can be due to various structures. The disc, the articular facet, epidural fibrosis, hypertrophy of ligament and flavum, etc., and instability and misalignments. These can also be dynamic. Diagnosis is particularly MRI, which is the gold standard because that allows detailed assessment of all the relevant structures. You don't really have spinal cord at this level, it's nerve roots within the vertebral canal. So you need to assess those. You can see the nerve roots, see whether they're enlarged, they have any reaction to being compressed, whether they have normal amounts of fat around them, etc., very well on MRI. Radiographs and CT can also show degenerative changes, although actually diagnosing exactly what components are contributing in an individual case, MRI is my personal preference. Electrodiagnostic testing can also be helpful. Lumbar sacral stenosis or degeneration in this area is pretty common in large breed dogs. So if you're not sure whether a dog presenting with sort of subtle pelvic limb signs or lameness, it's due to the lumbar sacral stenosis, whether that's clinically significant or not, then electrodiagnostic testing can be helpful. So conservative management is appropriate in some cases. This is analgesia, 6 weeks strict room rest, no stairs, sofas, things like that, particularly no jumping up because this is what puts most pressure through the base of the spine, treadmill, hydro, and walking up gentle inclines for rehab. And most cases do respond to conservative management. So it's usually, unless they've got quite severe signs, usually what I will try in the majority of cases initially. But unfortunately, a significant proportion recur after they return to normal exercises with conservative management. So other options are epidural steroid injections, with methylprednisolone acetate is reported in one study to give improvement in about 80% of cases. But again, signs can recur, and surgery is more challenging after you've done this. So we kind of recur these for cases where surgery is not an option, for example, due to their age, financial constraints, or other concurrent morbidities. Surgical management, again, there's been several techniques described, and because it's multifactorial, then your choice of technique will depend on where the compression is coming from and if there is instability. So on an individual patient by patient basis, there's not one technique that fixes all. A dorsal laminectomy is if you've got a disc that's causing most of the signs, then a dorsal laminectomy going from the top and removing that bone to give everything a little bit more room and remove the disc that's protruding is the usual way forward. And then in some cases, if we think there's a dynamic component, we might stabilize too. So clinical signs are the major determinant of outcome following surgery. About 80% of cases have a good to excellent outcome following dorsal laminectomy. But if they have urinary incontinence in particular, that predicts a poor outcome. So about 45% recovery if they're incontinent. And foraminotomy procedure has a similar reported success rate of about 80%. There's possible sort of post-surgical complications. Fibrosis in particular can lead to a recurrence of signs in a small proportion of cases, potentially more likely if they return to exercise early. Just a brief discussion of intervertebral disc disease in cats, as it's fairly uncommon in comparison with dogs, but we do see it. Typically, they get type 2 degeneration and chronic protrusions. Your L4S3 localization is most common in cats, and clinically significant disc herniations in the cervical region are rare. We also see traumatic nucleus pulposus extrusions in cats as well, so traumatic discs, for example, ones that have been hit by a car, etc. We can see them as a cause of neurological deficits. But your degenerative intervertebral disc disease, they tend to present with pain and acute or chronic progressive neurological deficits. We manage them in very similar way to dogs. Conservative management is appropriate in some cases, although cats are quite hard to rest. Surgical approaches are the same, and many cats are surprisingly tolerant of physio and hydrotherapy for rehab. So I've talked about management, including surgery. So I'm going to talk about post-op care and rehab next, which is arguably the most important bit, really. And it's possibly something that you've been involved in with post-op care for patients that you've referred, even if not doing spinal surgery, or conservatively managed patients which have had milder neurological deficits. So in any post-op patient, wound care and analgesia are important. So I'm not going to specifically cover those other than to say we usually use methadone, non-steroidals, based on personal preference, or we continue whatever's previously been started by the referring vet. And we use paracetamol post-operatively, and other sedation or analgesia is indicated. For example, if they might need a ketamine or medetomidine CRI, and we taper those over the next few days. And we usually add in gabapentin, which is good for neuropathic pain. And they'll go home on non-steroidals, paracetamol and gabapentin in the majority of cases. There are additional considerations for spinal patients postoperatively, though. They're likely to have significant neurological deficits, including urinary incontinence in the immediate postoperative period. So they're at risk of urinary retention, detrusor the damage if they have retention that's not observed and emptied quickly enough, at risk of urinary tract infections and scalding, etc. as well. They're often recumbent, so there's a risk of pressure sores and other skin lesions. Aspiration pneumonia is a risk in big deep-chested dogs that are recumbent, particularly if they have any pharyngeal or esophageal dysfunction. And they're at risk of gastrointestinal disturbance because of the stress of what's been happening, and particularly if they've received corticosteroids prior to referral. They're at risk of deterioration, so we need to observe their neurological status carefully as well. So post-op care is very important. Clean bedding, etc., regular turning and assisted standing can help prevent sores and aspiration. Harnesses can help if there's limited staffing. Physiotherapy and hydrotherapy, we start this in hospital, and following discharge, we send owners home with exercises to do. We have a physio that we work with who often is there at discharge importance and for recheck appointments as well to give sort of individualized plans, but sit to stand exercises, sway exercises, weight shifting exercises are pretty common ones for us to use, and they can certainly make a massive difference in rehab. Oops, going forward a bit quick. So often these cases, at least initially, we have a degree of bladder dysfunction. Often if it's a thoracolumbar disc, then they'll have upper motor neuron bladder with an increased sphincter tone and a large bladder that's difficult to express. Lower motor neuron ones from L4-S3 myelopathies with reduced sphincter tone and a small bladder and dribbling. So a lot of these cases we will at least have initially a urinary catheter in dwelling, because they're often easier to manage this way. And then after a couple of days, once their pain started to settle down after the surgery, and we've developed a bit of a bond with them in terms of being able to handle them, then we'll move to manual expression in cases where that's going to be possible. Urethral relaxants such as diazepam and prazosin can be very helpful as well. Monitoring by neurological assessment is very important. So particularly if we're in more severe cases where you've got, for example, absent deep pain perception post-operatively, we monitor neurological examination very, very carefully for signs of ascending myelomalacia. So we have a targeted neuro exam at least every day, and we expect that to be stable or improving. We look at movement, and if they have movement, whether this is coordinated, if they have proprioception, we look at their muscle mass. And what their muscle tone is like, if that's improving, and we check the reflexes. Cutaneous trunky is very important, which we talked about in sort of preoperative assessment as well. We expect that to start coming backwards. So we often, if they have a primipore in their back, mark that carefully on there so we can assess whether that's going in the right direction, or if not, then that can be a sign of developing myelomalacia. So yeah, we mark it with a pen so we know what it's doing. Patellar reflex is important and helpful, particularly if they've had a lesion affecting roots of the femoral nerve L4 and L5, and withdrawal we'll assess, particularly again if the roots of the sciatic L6, 7 and S1. We'll look at sensation, whether they've got superficial pain perception or deep pain perception, assessing those as well, and whether they're comfortable. A small proportion of cases can have a re-extrusion if they deteriorate after surgery. So there can be more disc that comes out in the sort of few days after surgery. So in that case, if they are deteriorating, an MRI and potentially revision surgery is indicated. And we do see cases that have had multiple disc surgeries. Sometimes, you know, we'd like all of our patients to be the little Daxi at the bottom that gets back to being walking well with a good tail wag, etc. But not always. Some cases, particularly the deep pain negative ones, don't recover. And for some animals and some owners, carts are appropriate for long-term management, but they have to understand there are difficulties with managing a chronically paraplegic dog, including bladder management and coping with an incontinent dog. But for those, carts are an option. Okay, do we have any questions?
There are no questions at the moment, Gemma, but if anyone does like to ask any questions, they can email them in to me. So on behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Gemma for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members' area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.